This is The Hawk. I'm Shlomo Zuckier.
I'm Avital Shishagoldschmidt.
And I'm Shlomo Brody.
Join us every other week as we discuss timely issues to Jewish communities on both sides of the Atlantic.
Whether it's Torah, culture, or politics, we have the latest Hawk you'll want to hear.
Hey, hello Shlomo, hello Avital, wonderful to see you.
Great to see you.
Great to be back.
Indeed, it's been a while. I'm joining you here from Israel, otherwise known as the Vaccination. We're very excited about that here. I understand it's snowing in New York.
Yeah, we some exciting weather in these parts. Though it's a spring or summer weather in Israel these days, from what I hear.
It is, but seeing all that snow in New York reminds me of the first time as an Israeli we had snow here. I was living in Gush Etzion. We had no shovels, so we took out our squeegees that we use for our showers, and we just basically moved the snow around. And it was made me feel like either both Israeli and Texan at that time. So. It's, I hope you guys are staying warm, and it's great to be together. A lot to cover. We've missed out on a lot, and let's get rolling. So unfortunately, you know, there's been a lot of, it's been a somber time in many ways, of course, for a lot of different ways and reasons this year. But certainly one of them is the deaths of many spiritual figures and rabbinic leaders. JTA had a very extensive article this past couple of days ago speaking in the aftermath of the, on a one day here in Israel, of the deaths of Rabbi David Soloveitchik of Brisk and Rabbi Yitzchak Shiner, and Dr. Abraham Chorsky. And of course, there's a long list as well, starting with the Novominsk Rebbe, or Yaakov Perlow earlier on in the period of the year. And then since then, of course, Rabbi Norman Lamb, Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz, Rabbi Nochem Eliezer Rabinovich, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Stacks, Rabbi David Feinstein, Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Rabbi Yudu Herzl Henkin, and others. And I think that, you know, many have been starting to think about, partly because of COVID, but partly because of the succession of so many deaths. What do these losses mean for the Jewish community and the present, and more particularly, what does it mean for the future of leadership? Who's going to fill those roles? Will those roles be filled by similar figures? And whatnot. So I thought it would be great to begin our conversation now about thinking about the future of Jewish leadership and where you think this is all going. Avital, why don't you start us off?
Sure. I think the sort of the big question it's not necessarily about, those we've lost. I think it's sort of an inevitable changing of the guard that this moment in time has brought. There was a generation that, unfortunately, of course, COVID tragically accelerated this, but we were coming to this point already for quite some years. And for me, the question is, and I say this as someone who's sort of sitting, in some ways on the sidelines of the rabbinate, the pulpit in America today, and sort of looking closely from, let's say, from the balcony, I think what I find interesting and most compelling is this question of like, who are going to be those new leaders? Are they going to be different in perspective on political issues, on hashkafic issues? Are they going to be more progressive? We don't know. I think there will be a bunch of sort of big ticket items that will be questions in, I think, the wider Orthodox community, whether from modern Orthodox to Haredi. There will be, I think those challenges exist in all of these communities, but obviously to different extents, or might have different solutions in each. And I'm curious who will be stepping into those shoes. I wonder and I worry about whether the next generation of Rabbanim are prepared to take tough stances at times. I think the last year especially, we've seen, unfortunately, with the deaths, right, we've also seen a great abdication of rabbinic leadership. And I think now there's going to be this big question hanging over the heads of Rabbanim who feel compelled to stand in this position, asking, are they ready to stand up? Are they ready to say Pikuach Nefesh comes first, or whatever is the challenge at the moment? I don't have an answer to this question. I'm worried about it.
I would say, I think there's really opposite, in some ways, there's opposite poles in terms of who the next group of leaders will be. On the one hand, what we've seen in recent years is a move towards decentralization. So instead of, you know, large institutions put people at their helm who are the leaders, and that's, you know, sort of everyone follows them. I think that in recent years, just because of social media, there are new ways to gain followings. And just like we see in politics, you know, if you're good on the socials, or if you can compel people in other ways to follow your teaching and to be students, there are ways of becoming leaders, not through institutions. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, and that's a path that's different than the path that so many of the people that were mentioned before pursued, where largely they ascended through institutions, centralized institutions. On the other hand, in the last year, I mean, Avital, you said there's been some abdication of leadership. I think in some circles, we've all discussed this before, it's been an opportunity to step up. Precisely, if people who have institutional leadership have the capacity to do so much more, if they do take the difficult stance and are willing to go out on a limb to do the right thing, as I think many have done in the OU and YU world. So I think that there are these opposite poles right now. I think the longer term trend is towards a decentralized system where, you know, we're going to hear new names and people just sort of, you know, pop up. And more recently, it's been more institutionalized, I think, because of COVID, but I think that's going to rapidly change. So I think that doesn't answer the question of what their values are going to be, but it does point to a more populist model, which I think does shape that question a little bit.
Yeah, I think we should probably distinguish, though, between different types of positions of influence. And, you know, if you think about the names we mentioned before, first of all, there's sort of some more in the monorthodox world, some in the more yeshivish world, and there are real differences in how those communities function. I mean, the case of sort of the modern Orthodox figures, whether it's Rabbi Lam, Rabbi Gedali Dov Schwartz, or Nachum Eliezer Zibunovich, they're all heads of very important institutions, a Beis Din, a university, yeshiva. They all had successors already, and actually for some years already. So, you know, that's one method of thinking about new leadership. In, let's say, the case of, you know, Rabbi, you know, Meshulam David Soloveitchik in Brisk, I mean, he was very well advanced. And they sort of announce the successor at the funeral. That, you know, creates all sorts of dynamics, although I imagine that his son has been quite active in the leadership role in the yeshiva until then. So, you know, I think each of those types of institutions pose different challenges in terms of thinking about who's going to be the next successor and the leader. Where I think it's probably most complex is when you get to thought leaders, not just, you know, institutional leaders, but people that are leading in terms of ideas. And here, you know, I think Rabbi Steinsaltz in his own way, Rabbi Chwersky in his own way, were very pioneering, didn't fit into any camp particularly easily, as well as the things that made him so fascinating. I don't know who those next figures are, but they were very fascinating figures. And, you know, and certainly Rabbi Sacks as chief rabbi, of course, he had a successor, but as sort of leading theologian, it's not really clear who else is on the bench right now, you know, who's coming in. You know, I think that leaves a real vacuum, those three figures in particular. Now, all of them, of course, great figures. But in terms of thinking about who's going to be sort of innovating new ideas and pioneering sort of new pathways of thinking and thought.
Right. And I wonder how much the question of pioneering and new is what people are looking for. Meaning the more this is a reflection of people's interests and values, some people want same old, right? And, you know, one... Vizaracha Shemesh Uva Shemesh. So one Soloveitchik passes away and you hire the next Soloveitchik to head your institution. So I think groups that want innovation will find it. And I think for some people, that means changes in all sorts of ways. For some communities, you know, all the names that I think that you mentioned were Ashkenazi men. So I think some people are invested in broadening the structure of leadership. And there, you know, there were some women who passed away in the past year, mostly in the yeshivish community, who had leadership roles, Rebetzin Chaya Osband, Rebetzin Rachel Altain, and Aviva Weisbord, all leaders. And so that, you know, that for some communities, those are leaders. I think in other communities, you know, would like to see that be something more. And obviously that's controversial, but I guess the question is, it's really more up to communities to promote people, I think. And to figure out what they're looking for. So I think if you think about it from a demand perspective rather than a supply perspective, to use Seyman terminology around these things, that's another way of looking at it that I think is often helpful.
Yeah, I wonder about, you're right about the demand piece, that much of this depends on the Balabatim, on the lay leadership, right? Who determine what is needed. And you're right also about the decentralization of leadership, where it's, you know, I think it's going to be very interesting who is going to be using also these sort of, internet social media tools to put their ideas out there. I think that will be something we'll be seeing more and more of from the rabbinate. And you're right, and they might be more populist figures because of that, because they'll be sort of gathering, following from the Amcha rather than from sort of some established view of where the community is.
Well, you know, here in Israel in particular, we see already that trend. Makor Rishon had a whole special edition of influential Israelis, a religious Zionist, and they were speaking about this a little bit, about the sort of the informal figures who don't really have positions. And so, you know, I definitely understand that argument for the decentralization, and that's where it's going to spring from. But I would not underestimate still the power and importance of, you know, central institutions to have real impact. Meaning, whoever sits as the Rosh, you know, the Av Bez Din of a big Bet Din or of an institution of university or yeshiva, there's a lot of built-in sort of influence there, which I think, you know, you can't underestimate. So those figures who are going to pop up, I think is going to be interesting. And I think you're right, you know, Shlomi, you also mentioned the point about, you know, where the women leadership is going to come from. I mean, that's obviously a huge deal. And once again, you have a certain number of institutions where you see, women are very prominent in those institutions. And then you see it also as well, like informally, how women have gotten very, you know, influential. I mean, here in Israel, the whole Hadran movement that made a big deal about women taking over Daf Yomi, which is basically like a small initiative out of Renana, which, you know, I got an email about 18 months beforehand and asked me, you know, could I help out a little bit and support it? And I was like, okay, this is interesting. And who knew that it was going to become like a huge deal and get hundreds, you know, probably thousands of women and men for that matter, learning Daf Yomi now. So, you know, that's sort of an exciting phenomenon. And I'm not as partly because I think some of the figures that passed away this year, unfortunately, had been less active over the last few years anyway, because of, you know, sort of their health situations. And partly because I think there's a lot of exciting leadership out there. I'm not as, sort of skeptical or nervous about the future of leadership. I'm curious where it's going to come from. But I'm optimistic in that respect.
Right. One thing that I think is interesting about what you mentioned about the Hadron initiative taking off is something that I think is really underserved, certainly in the modern Orthodox and Dati Lumi communities, which is promoting opportunities for women to learn Daf Yomi or at higher levels. And for all the controversy around leadership, there's a lot less around learning. And there have been articles, I think, Avital, you may have even written one about Haredi women learning Gemara in Israel. Degrees of that in Chabad in the U.S. And though that's somehow less controversial and I think fitting with the trend of what we've been talking about, sometimes leadership, you gain leadership not from having a title or a position, but from just having the knowledge and the expertise that leads people to respect you. And
and a platform of some sort, yeah.
And the platform. And now anyone can have a platform. You can even just start your own podcast or something with a couple of friends.
Call it the Hack. You know, yeah.
Maybe we can do a crossover, Hakdrun. What do you think?
Yeah.
sounds very catchy. But I think there's real opportunities here in terms of where leadership will come from, and it won't necessarily be the places you expect because it's, you know, even the education is decentralized too.
Right. I do happen to think though that there is a distinction between Israel and America when it comes to this, right? And if you look at women's learning in particular, that we're seeing that stark contrast, I think, most, in that issue, where in Israel, it's not as politicized. And we see that like from the beginning with Nishmat, the way it was sort of gone about, it was just a very strategic plan to sort of normalize women's high learning, Torah learning. And in America, we obviously, I think there's culturally different way of going about it. The economics are different here as well. And I think it's just going to take a lot longer here for that specifically to take hold, but more also, you know, about many other issues. I think in Israel, we see a lot more interestingly progressive political growth that we don't see in the States in the Orthodox community. So we should just keep those two apart, I think, because the trends will be different. And I'm not sure that in America, the next stage of leadership is necessarily going to be that much more progressive. But then again, having been at the REITs and the Rebbetzin's conferences lately, pre-pandemic, but even the virtual ones, I'm seeing a lot of interesting shifts, specifically on women and attitudes to LGBTQ inclusion, that I was really shocked at behind closed doors. But there's sort of much more comfort with talking about issues just being issues, right? Not sweeping them under the rug.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's quite interesting. And your point about the Israel-America divide is important. Although I think the secret in Israel has sort of been there are a lot of institutions now. And so sort of people sort of do their thing and, you know, whether you like it or not, you know, just sort of it's happening.
It's part of the decentralization theme. It fits.
That's right. It's part, well, again, it's decentralized, but they're actually running real institutions. Like they built real platforms.
Yeah.
You know, but I would note that, unfortunately, as someone who very much supports higher Torah, you know, women learning higher Torah, higher levels of Torah, I don't see in the horizon someone filling the role of like a Rav Gedaliah Dov Schwartz or like a real POSEC and, you know, coming from these institutions, meaning I don't think women's learning is there yet, regretfully, not because of capabilities, of course, but because of education and the years of training and whatnot. And I don't think we're there yet. So some of those realms of influence, my guesses are not coming from women, which is unfortunate. But
of course, I think that is a matter of time. And I think it's also going to largely rely on Israeli institutions. We're not seeing that sort of that level here in the States.
Right. Oh, I'm hopeful you're right. But at least in the short term,
yeah.
You know, that's where, you know, that's where it is. But again, you know, the models that existed that, you know, some of these figures created, some of them were filling models that existed before, some created new. So I'm very much anticipating both men and women creating new models as well. And I think that'll be, you know, sort of exciting. And hopefully whenever we get out of Corona, and I don't know when that's going to be anymore, you know, this variation and that variation and God knows, but whenever that is, I think there's gonna be a lot of energy to try to so start things up anew.
I do think there. I'm not totally selling out the U.S. for offering opportunities for learning for men or for women personally. But I think there need to be more institutions and more advanced institutions. You know, in Israel, if you're a woman who wants to learn for a decade, you have the places to do it and the places to be supported doing that. In America, however, wherever you are on whatever spectrum, there's just no institution that really provides for that. The way to produce expertise is by having people sit and learn and write. Those opportunities are, you know, unfortunately less than they should be here, but I think that's rectifiable.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So let's turn now to our recommendations. We'll all recommend some things that we've seen that we would recommend to you for your reading or experience. We've had some music over our episodes. Okay, why don't we start with Avital?
Sure. I had the pleasure of recently reading Zev Elef's latest book. I had it on my shelf for a while, but I just never got around to it. And now in pandemic life, I've been sort of reading a lot more voraciously. The book is titled Authentically Orthodox, a Tradition-Bound Faith in American Life. The book, according to its description, which was true in the reading experience as well, the book moves beyond sermons and synagogues and examines the webs of experiences mediated by any number of American cultural forces. So there are just, you know, two examples. Elef looks at the debate over the kashrus of peanut oil for Pesach. And the another sort of memorable moment was where he looked at the Yeshiva University team in College Bowl. I'm blanking on what year that was in, but some decades ago, and sort of the way that the community rallied around it. I thought the book was particularly fascinating to read in the lens of where we are right now. This book came out right, I think 2019 or maybe early 2020, right before the pandemic, and reading it sort of during COVID with my mind on post-COVID and where the Jewish communities will be, looking at lived experiences beyond these institutions, beyond the sermons, beyond the shul, I thought was very relevant. Speaking of decentralization. So I highly recommend it. It's a fun read. It's academic, but very accessible.
Before we go to Shlomo Brody, just a note that, you know, back in the 60s, the College Bowl is what people rallied around, the YU College Bowl team. And nowadays it's the YU basketball team. And read in what you will about trends in the community.
I don't know, now that Amari Stoudemire is giving inspirational Musar Shmuzes to the YU guys 100%. About the difficulties of learning Gemara as opposed to covering Shaq in basketball, I think that this justifies all of that. Perhaps.
As someone pointed out, it was a missed opportunity. They should have asked Shaq versus Shaq LaVitaria, but they didn't even formulate it right. But very exciting. Amari Stoudemire Shlita.
Indeed. So I'm going to recommend a book by Professor Benny Porat in Hebrew called Tzedek Dalim. It's a book about the notions of social justice and the notions of welfare from the Torah to Chazal. It is a nuanced, very sophisticated analysis of both Tanakh and Chazal. It sort of breaks all the molds right, left, sensibly delves into a lot of issues about obligations and support and rights. And I think a lot of the discourse about quote unquote social justice, which of course is a term that doesn't appear in Tanakh, but seemingly is something that Jews did and should care about. It's a very good analysis to sort of raise the level of what Judaism has to offer to that conversation.
Oh, great. I hadn't heard of that. Looking forward to looking it up. I'm going to recommend something a little different. Alexei Navalny's courtroom speech, which you can see a video of it in the Russian, but there also are translations out there. And the New York Times, of course, the Russian dissident who was poisoned and recovered, left the country, and then returned after investigating and proving that the government was behind it, returned, was arrested, and recently, as part of his trial, attacked and derided Putin. It's been recommended before me in a way by Natan Sharansky. Who, of course, went through a similar, not the same. He never left Russia in the first place. He wanted to get to Israel. But, similarly, a Russian dissident decades ago and living through that, I think the sort of courage that people like Alexei Navalny or Natan Sharansky have is just so remarkable. And in a world where it's hard to stand up for your values, you know, even in much more limited ways, they provide a model for that. And, something we can all, I don't know, aspire to. Most of us won't face that, but at least think about how much we really believe in our values of democracy, our values of fairness, of freedom, and or whatever other values, and what are we willing to give up for that? So that's the Musser Sefer recommendation, the courtroom speech.
Beautiful. I really that was really well put. One can argue that Sharansky is part of, the Refusnik movement, and many historians have made the argument that that was part of the thing that really shook the Soviet Union and brought it to its knees. So time will only tell what Navalny will do, but from my reading of Russian dissident media and keeping a close track and talking to people on the ground there, it seems like this is going to be a turning point in the country's future.
Yeah, I don't mean to try to take the spot of like Russia expert on this podcast. That's certainly that's certainly you, Avital, and you're allowed to quote Lairhouse founders, and we'll call it even.
Deal. I can't comment more on the situation, but we'll put it there. We'll leave it at that. I wanted to talk about something else slightly different, but really I think actually relates to this discussion of values, as you just said, Shlomo. This question about alliances, political alliances. In both the States and in Israel, we're seeing some rather complicated alliances. And I think let's keep this specific to the firm community just for the sake of really keeping this focused. Whether it's Orthodox Jews defending Marjorie Taylor Greene, despite her clearly anti-Semitic statements or differently, I think Lahavdil, but still, you know, problematic in Israel with this new Smotrich-Ben-Gvir merge. There's this larger question, I think, here, which is about making political bedfellows with those whose views one may find repugnant in some ways, but one needs to, in order to sort of strengthen one side, prevent the other side from winning. What do you think about that? What, I know we're in different sides of the ocean here, but it seems it is a sort of, it was a question, I think, in the last 4 years here in the States, a really big question that many of us were struggling with, and it's certainly not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, I think the question of who one associates with in politics is particularly complicated because for a lot of people, politics is all about results. And, you know, as long as you get what your platform is, so you can partner with whoever you want. And of course, the cost of doing that sort of business is that, especially for a religious community, you associate your values with the people that that you need to go along the way. And, you know, at some point, your people even forget that this is a transactional business and start buying in. So, you know, there obviously has to be some balance because you're not going to agree with most people. Yeah, everyone has differences of opinion on some things, but I think people who are best known for very repugnant things, I have a hard time seeing associating with them even for political game, even in that arena.
Well, you know, I'm pretty sympathetic to what you're saying, Shlomo, but you know, let's think about what the argument is of those who would say, listen, X, Y, and Z person is repugnant. We don't agree with their views, but, okay. So the Israeli example for, you know, which has come up a lot because we've had a lot of elections, right, over the last couple of years. And you know, the Israeli example here, I think the argument is basically sort of along the lines of, well, we don't agree with Ben-Gvir or former followers of Kahana, but, and usually it's like a what about, right? What about the left? What about what's going on in the joint, you know, Rishima Meshutefet, the joint Arab list, which is no longer running together, but in previous elections did. They have a lot of radical figures there. And the reason why that list was created was because they didn't want to lose votes, right, to fall under the threshold. And so you had to bring everyone in to make sure no votes were lost. And so once the left is doing it, then don't we on the right have to do it as well? And this has sort of been the strategy that Netanyahu has been seemingly behind the scenes advocating, and you know, and many are sort of following into that argument. I understand where that's coming from, but I think we can see the deep, you know, costs of such a strategy, which is that basically you're legitimizing and bringing into the Knesset something which is a type of opinion which we really want to keep out of power. And it's really, really important. And it really misrepresents our community in a very profound way. Now, here in Israel, I think that part of what's been going on, though, is that some of the people that are joining up, say Ben-Gvir, don't necessarily see his ideas as that problematic. You know, it's a shade a little bit more to the right or a little bit, you know, different or whatever it might be. And in Israel, they call it the bloch techni, the technical block. You know, we'll run together and then we'll split off in the Knesset.
Did you say a bluff techni or bluff techni, right? It's a bluff. It's all a bluff. At the end of the day, you're a party. I think that's been the pushback.
Yeah, oh, that is the pushback. And you know, at the end of the day, it also, partly because Israel and the religious Zionist community has itself built into this like model, we have to have an official representative of our movement. So then it becomes a very loaded thing that you have these representatives in the Knesset. So I'm hopeful. I regret the fact that that this is going on. I mean, Ben-Gvir has no place in the Knesset in my mind. But you know, we should at least understand what the argument is and what the temptation is, because it is a strong temptation to be smart in politics.
Well, I think part of the issue is not just the fact that this may be kosher, right? Someone like Ben-Gvir, but in the end of the day, this can easily backfire, right? Maybe it's a bloch techni, but the moment you're in the Knesset, you've empowered someone with those sorts of views to be making policy decisions, right? There are going to be actual implications. This is not just like a sort of a performative alliance. It's a real one at the end of the day. It gives power to people who one may find repugnant. You may think it's sort of, again, it may seem technical now, but if they get in and if the government lasts for longer than a few months, there will be real consequences.
And I guess another piece of this is, and it's not exactly the same issue, but it touches on it, is that, you know, the Dati Lumi political representation historically in the early days was always focused on religious issues, and their goal was to partner with whatever government and not to get involved in the politics. And at this point, we've reached such an extreme that, you know, not only, forget about Ben-Gvir, even Smutrich's party is called the Religious Zionist Party. But the main thing held in common by the people who voted for him is the extreme right views on territorial issues, which you know, obviously for some people are tied to religion, but are the central political issue for many in Israel. So there's been this elision between politics and religion in Israel that, you know, that basically the two are conflated in this way. And the question is, what's left of the religious? Now, of course, there are, you know, religious policies that that those parties will have as well, but you know, you're playing with dangerous games here, and that I think that raises the stakes. Meaning, then you partner with, you know, with people who have been, you know, maybe not themselves, but are associated with those who are effectively, you know, banned from Knesset because they're terrorists, or they've threatened people and threatened terrorism or the like, and you've made that part of your religious ideology. That's the risk.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big risk. By the way, I definitely distinguish between Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and their ideological views. I mean, there are real differences there. But, you know, and I hope I didn't, you know, come give an impression otherwise, but there are real risks here. And, you know, I think the biggest risk is just basically saying that some things cannot represent Torah. And this is something we saw also in America, right? With, and again, you know, I didn't support Trump. I didn't like Trump. I don't like Trump. I'm very happy that man is not in power anymore. I understood why people voted for
Trump. So you accept the results of the election, just check.
I do. And even before January 6th. And especially since I never voted for him. So that works out even better for me. But I understood why people voted for Trump. What I did not understand and thought was a terrible thing is how people supported Trumpism. And it's the same thing here in Israel. Once you make political alliances, your ideology can be impacted. It's not just a matter of sort of common interest or common policy votes. Your ideology can really get impacted. So, you know, in that respect, and you're seeing even, I think, the boomerang of what they did the last time when they tried to bring everyone together, which is now that Smotrich is joined with Ben-Gvir and he's basically dumped the Bayi Yehudi. And so the Bayi Yehudi right now has, well, it's only 9:30 here in Israel. There's 2.5 more hours to the list have to be submitted. So you never know, but it seems right now, it could have been already decided that they're gonna be running independently. And that probably means that they don't get into the Knesset. It's a good chance that Ben-Gvir and Smotrich don't get into the Knesset. And that could very well end the whole future of the religious Zionist parties here in Israel. I actually would not be upset about that myself, although I'd be upset about the wasted votes on the right. But I wouldn't be upset about that. And I think that it's just going to reflect the reality that the religious Zionist community in Israel doesn't really want anymore and hasn't wanted for a long time, like their own party. I mean, they've never had the votes that they think they, of the people they think they represent. People vote for Likud, they vote for whatever alternative to the Likud is on the right, or they vote for some centrist party, whatever it might be in the given year. And the one time they had a lot of votes was when Bennett brought in a lot of votes from non-religious people. So, you know, I think we're going to see, and I'm actually wouldn't be upset about this, a shift in the way that the religious Zionist community finally sees itself. But, you know, time will tell. Or we'll just have another election in 4 months. That's the other possibility.
As I understand, the religious Zionist community, I mean, like most communities, is sort of homogenized, I think, often by the media as being one way. But there's a lot more ideological diversity within the community and its views in politics. Am I wrong? Like, I mean, I'm standing from outside, but.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of diversity to a certain extent. But obviously, right now, no, what I'm saying like this is that there used to be, you would have like a real more like religious Zionists who are on the left, both economically, socioeconomically, and on Arab-Israeli issues. That segment is much weaker today. And so, you know, I know many people, even if they're more left, who will vote maybe Yesh Atid or Gantz or whatever other central parties out there. Very few right now are voting Labor and certainly not Meretz. So that spectrum right now is, and there's numerous polls that have showed this. And so the spectrum has become limited, but what I think is different is the issues that people are actually really passionate about within the religious Zionist community. Meaning some people, settlements are really, really important, or you know, the Arab-Israeli conflict. Some people right now, the justice ministry and sort of separation of powers, that's become huge. For some people, it's so social issues or economic issues. For some, it's Datu Medina, right? Or where are we going with the Haredi? There's like a real, and I think that's part of the divide and division right now about who the religious community is gonna vote for.
Right, and I guess that your suggestion that, or what you said you'd be interested in to see there'd be no more religious party, in a sense would, you know, sort of just the natural progression that leads you from religious parties that work with any political party to religious parties that get politicized to just, well, at some point, let's, you know, the charade is up, let's just have political parties. And it's sort of the natural progression. And then the question is how do, you know, people with interest in having their religious concerns catered to within politics, how do they do that? And the Haredim figured out how to do that. You build a huge party and you have a ton of influence, but that would basically be totally lost. And again, maybe there aren't that many special interests, but I think there are, I think there are people who there are definitely ways to influence the country, both on religious issues and on ethical issues that, let's say, someone like Rav Amital had a vision to do. And he was left wing for his political career, certainly, but it's something if you're left, you can influence the country as a religious party, as long as you're playing the game and as long as you don't overly politicize yourself. And I think that's really been lost already. And as you're saying, you know, if the religious parties close up shop, maybe we're not losing too much at this point.
Yeah. Could be, but go ahead, Avital, please, Avital.
I just wanted to comment on something, Miles, that you said earlier, if that's okay, about this, you know, Trump versus Trumpism and I think there are many parallels for that outside of the states and other countries and other political systems. I think you're right. I think the danger is when that political support converts into an ideological identity. And much of that identity is based on fear mongering and on propaganda, right? This is a very concerted effort to convert someone who may have voted for Trump in 2016 because of Israel to where we came to in 2020, right? And I think you're right in Israel as well, that's really the danger, right? There certainly are differences between Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, but it's not a huge leap, right? Especially once at the moment that they decide to merge, it's a very slippery slope.
Well, it is. There is definitely a slippery slope there. And, you know, partly of what's, you know, going on is people just take into account political survival of their ideas and their interest. And by the way, you know, if you think back in the American case, you know, with all the criticism I have of, let's say, Orthodox support for Trumpism, we should not discount the fact that in 4 years with all the mess and all the horror that happened in America, there are some real political accomplishments. Right. A, with regard to Israel, and B, with regard to the judiciary, in particular with regard to religious liberty and the future of religious liberty, that are real accomplishments for those who have those, you know, political views. And so, you know, it sometimes works, meaning political alliances and being smart about that actually can have payoffs. And those payoffs might not be worth it. And, you know, I'm fully sympathetic to that view, but we should recognize that there are real trade-offs to not being willing to making political alliances with those that you don't like. And so in the case in Israel, the trade-off right now could be if you're on the right and you very much want a right-wing prime minister. So it's possible that because you lose votes here, you don't get a right-wing prime minister. I mean, and what happened, you know, in the first election, I mean, it was a surprise, of course, that Lieberman didn't run, you know, didn't join in the end with Netanyahu, but if Bennett gets in, you know, to the Knesset for a little bit of votes, whatever this or that, they have a very strong right-wing government. So that didn't work by 800 votes. So, right, it's complicated, right, to see about, you know, how these things go. And we should just recognize that there's a real political cost to standing up for your values. You should stand up for your values, but recognize it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it goes back to the question of you know, power or interests versus values and what you stand for and what impact that's going to have reverberating back on your community, 100%. And I mean, people don't always know their interests, but sometimes and off, maybe even often people know how to vote their interests. And the question is, you know, to what extent is that legitimate when there are real countervailing moral concerns?
Yeah. I'd also add, by the way, that the criticisms we're talking about right now are on the right, because the right's been in political power, both in Israel and America. But, you know, I would warn my friends on the left, I would say, as someone who identifies as a conservative, beware, because particularly when you have narrow alliances or narrow governments, like in America, we have 50-50 in the Senate, it's a tight thing in the House, many states are being run by Republicans, there's going to be many temptations to partner and build alliances with those on the extremes that are, you know, when you have the opportunity of power, are very tempting. Yeah. I'm not going to name names of who I think those temptations might be in the American scene, but I think it's a very real temptation.
And I think for the Jewish community in particular, I really think it's incumbent on people to call out anti-Semitism or, you know, or that sort of thing on their own side. So I think like the RJC, the Republican Jewish Coalition, they called out MTG when she talked about her Jewish friend Laser and how he was wreaking havoc in California. And they called her out, and, you know, that was part of the momentum within the party to push back on her. And I think you had a little bit of that in previous years where whoever it was said something about Jews and money, whatever the details were, I don't remember all of it, but, you know, you get some pushback. The expectation is, sorry?
Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, right, okay. Right. So the expectation is, you know, people say things that are clearly beyond the pale and anti-Semitic. It's the job of the Jewish supporters to stand up for their people. And it doesn't always happen, which is why this is necessary to mention. But that's a case where it's values and interests go together, meaning, no, if you're a Jewish Republican, you really don't want the Republican Party to be anti-Semitic. That's a pretty big no-no. And yet, sometimes for people, their internal political concerns outweigh their actual loyalty to the Jewish community. And it makes you wonder what makes this a Jewish interest group as opposed to just a wing of the Republican or Democratic Party, as the case may be.
Well, you know, the advantage of all the chaos, of course, at least looking at from abroad, is that we have many great Purim costumes to choose from this year. I mean, I can dress up as Bernie at the Capitol Hill. I can dress up as a Viking from the Capitol Hill, right? Two incidents at Capitol Hill, right? There's so many options right now. I can be the guy taking the shtender. There's many things which I think you can get away with in Israel, which is a little bit too soon in the American scene.
And it might even be too soon for an American Israeli podcast. We'll have to find out. we'll let you know what the feedback is here. But and then on the other side, you have the people who want to dress up like a Corona cell or something like that.
I was about to say, my kids, I asked them what they wanted to be for Purim this year, and my son said, I want to be a superhero. And I said, which superhero would you like to be? And he said, I'd like to be a doctor.
Oh, wow.
That's really sweet. Yeah. Oh,
that's actually very inspiring. So you see all the silver linings of this could be that people be inspired to dress up as doctors and not Vikings.
Maybe
so,
even to be doctors.
Even that as well. So
a Jewish doctor.
Who would have thought?
I like the sound of it, yeah. All right, well, until next time, it's been a good hack.
Absolutely, wonderful to see you all.
Thank you guys, good to see you.
Bye-bye. If you liked our show, you'll want to follow our podcast.
Subscribe to the Hawk podcast wherever you get your pods, and make sure to follow the three of us on social media for live events. We are your hosts, Avital Chizhak Goldschmidt,
Shlomo Zuckier,
and Shlomo Brody. Thank you for listening to the Hawk.